is a good example. People in the South End want this to be the start of a green economic development in that community. And we would like to see them also transition to 100% electric vehicles, trucks going into the Port of Albany. There's a
Hey, this is David Poe, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Greenville Drive-In 32, a destination for movies and music under the stars of the Northern Catskills since 1959. Seasonal programming information at drivein32.com or 518-966-2177.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Scout of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
There is currently no vaccine or specific medication to treat COVID-19. Testing is limited in the United States. The only way to flatten the curve is through collective action. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend that all Americans practice social distancing to slow the spread of the disease and to keep from overloading the American medical system. This means staying at home and avoiding other people.
Palatial administrative offices, fountain included. Hello and welcome to the Thingularity radio program, broadcasting from the Palatial Administrative Offices of the Catskill Makers Syndicate, located at 65 West Bridge Street, right next to the Juice Branch. How is everybody doing tonight?
Yay!
Whoa. Yeah!
Okay,
great!
We are all definitely alive, and our guest tonight is Christopher Carson.
Pleased to be with you!
Yes.
He is... somebody you guys might already know because he's been on the show before. He's been a spectacular guest, and we're looking to have another good, fun night tonight. To my left is... what?
Go ahead.
Intro, so people intro. Know who we're talking. Ben, to my left.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. Brian, hiding in the back.
Yo!
Albert, how you doing?
Hey there.
Cody?
Hi, y'all.
Hey, and Professor Vaughn, Mother's Bob.
Yo.
That is everybody, and now you kind of know what they sound like, but we will get jumbled. Anybody got anything they want to bring up tonight before we dive into the guest, or vice versa?
Whoa!
Diving into him. We won't be getting into moon colonization, I don't think.
No, that was last time.
Ooh, do we have a topic available? Anything? Anybody? Grab bag. Don't make me start pulling out random words.
I think he had a conversation starter of some kind that had to do with a mug. We don't have.
Yes, I have here, and those of you on the radio can't actually see it, which is your loss. This wonderful commemorative mug, which says Rochester Gas and Electric, world's longest commercial Westinghouse reactor run, 189 days, July 22nd, 1973. Now, for those of you who don't know about Rochester Gas and Electric, this is a commemorative mug. It's got a picture on it of the Paul R. Genet Station. Paul R. Genet Station is a single-unit nuclear power station near Rochester, as you might imagine. It is the second oldest by a month and pretty much the smallest nuclear generating unit in the United States today. The one that's a month older is actually Nine Mile Point, also in upstate New York. Now, interesting thing about this, Paul Arjuna, who was he? Well, he was a utility executive who firmly believed in the potential of nuclear energy. He was the head of the Power Reactor Development Corporation, which built the Enrico Fermi Fast Breeder Reactor outside Detroit.
Brian?
You may have encountered a book that went by the title of We Almost Lost Detroit, which described an accident which occurred at the Enrico Fermi Fast Breeder about 1970. It should be pointed out that no one was in danger of having their city blown up or anything of that nature. Actually, the most interesting thing about it to me was that there was fuel melting and that the reactor was actually then repaired and decontaminated, repaired and returned to service, which is one of at least three incidents I know of where a sodium-cooled, liquid sodium-cooled reactor actually suffered a fuel melting accident and was repaired and returned to service, which is really quite interesting. Anyway, but...
Wait, could you tell me about when that occurred?
Right about 1970.
Okay.
The Enrico Fermi, anyway, that's a story for another day, but the Paul Arjuna station, so yes, this is commemorating the longest commercial power run of a Westinghouse reactor, 189 days in 1973. Now, you might ask yourself, I mean, now, that was when the station was nearly new. It's over 50 years old now. It'll be 52 years old come December 10th. Surely, you know, 189 days, that's almost half a year. How is it performing nowadays? Well, if you go to the International Atomic Energy Agency's Power Reactor Information Service, you'll learn something quite interesting. Because IAEA, PRIS, that's your mouthful of letters for the day, tabulates availability factor of nuclear power units. I don't know anybody who tabulates this for any other kind of power unit, but IAEA, PRIS tabulates it for nuclear units. And Jhene performs remarkably well. In 2016, in fact, it shows 100.0% availability, meaning that it ran all 365 days of that year without stopping. The previous and subsequent years, 94.9%, which tells you that they were running 18-month fuel cycles with a 90-day shutdown for refueling and regular maintenance. Anyway, so that's actually kind of amazing that this 50-year-old plus power plant is running pretty much 360, 350 days out of the average year.
But I thought nuclear is dangerous.
I mean, is it dangerous? Well, one thing I can tell you is that this, like I say, 50-year-old power plant, which is still achieving regularly better than 90% load averages, that kind of tells me that these plants must be well-engineered, well-constructed, well-maintained, and well-operated, or otherwise they'd never be able to do that. On the other side of the lake in Ontario, right, earlier in the year, Darlington, one of their units came off a continuous power run of 1,102 days. Wow. Now, Jhene or other U.S.-type power reactors could never do that. That's not physically feasible because they have to refuel roughly every 18 months. When they were first built, they refueled every 12 months, but the fuel handling has been modified over the years, so they refuel every 18 months, typically. Whereas the CANDU reactors they use in Canada, those are refueled continuously, so they never have to shut them down unless either something goes wrong or they have some kind of scheduled maintenance or inspection or whatever, Darlington Unit 2 was shut down on schedule after 1,102 continuous days of operation.
So what you're saying is the United States did it better?
So far as I know, this is not just the longest continuous power run of a nuclear power station. It's the longest continuous power run of a steam power station of any kind ever.
And this is Nine Mile Point.
So that was Darlington. Darlington in Ontario. Darlington, like I say, across the lake.
The Canadians, not...
Okay.
Yeah.
The Canadians now got it right.
Okay.
Now, 9 Mile Point. Let's look at 9 Mile Point Unit 1, right, which is the other, like I say, Janay and 9 Mile Point 1 are the oldest and smallest nuclear units operating in this country today.
Fun fact, I grew up next to 9 Mile Point. I spent a large part of my adolescence 6 miles away from it. That cool. might explain a thing or two.
6 Mile Point.
But yeah, and so here's a fun one. According, again, to IAEA PRIS, availability of 9 Mile Point Unit 1 during 2020, 100.0%. It did not shut off either on schedule or because of a failure of equipment or anything. It ran continuously.
Wait, this is
during the entire year of 2020.
That's the, okay. So the pandemic. So during the pandemic, it had no issues. Day. That's okay.
As a matter of fact.
I would just like to kind of point that out.
As a matter of fact, it shows an annual load factor of 101.6%, which is to say it was actually generating more than its rated output.
Wait a minute.
Does that mean that it was getting drawn from more? Because doesn't nuclear just kind of add to the base load and then other sources come online during peak power?
So 101.6 annual load factor, what that really means is the rated load is based on a certain outdoor temperature. And so during the colder months of the year, you can actually run the power plant harder. And that's probably what that reflects. But yeah, nuclear power plants, now they can vary their output. Some can and some can't. I ought to be more honest here. Some nuclear power plants are dedicated baseload units that cannot vary their output meaningfully. Most units can, but they don't. Why do they not bother? Well, the answer simply is that they're very, very low variable cost of generation. Means that you don't save much money by cutting back to 50% output. The cost of a kilowatt hour from a nuclear station is pretty low. So the more kilowatt hours you can sell, the better off you are. And again, we're talking about 9 Mile Point and Janay 1, right? 9 Mile Point 1 and Janay, which are more than 50 years old. They're completely paid off, right? The mortgage for those was paid off in 20 years. So every kilowatt hour that they generate is essentially pure profit.
Right.
Interesting.
Now, that's the power of nuclear. We're still paying off those solar panels.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing. People talk, you know, people laugh. They say, oh, yeah, they promised us nuclear energy too cheap to meter back in the 50s. Well, ignoring the fact that was a speech by Admiral Louis Strauss, head of the Atomic Energy Commission, talking about fusion. The fact is, nuclear energy too cheap to meter is a reality. The point is, too cheap to meter doesn't mean too cheap to charge for. It just means that the cost of a kilowatt hour, the incremental cost of a kilowatt hour, is meaningless. And so you just charge, you know, it would be more economical to charge people a fixed fee than to bother and find out how much they used. And how do you know when this is happening? Well, I can tell you it's happening in Ontario. Why do I know it's happening in Ontario? In Ontario, they set the electricity rates quarterly. Well, if you look at Ontario electricity rates, it turns out the rates are highest in the spring and fall and lowest in the summer and winter. In other words, they're inversely proportional to the number of kilowatt hours taken out of the system. Power loads are lower in the spring and the fall because it's temperate, higher in the summer because of air conditioning, higher in the winter because of heating. Well, the implication here is if power costs are essentially flat, right, no matter how many kilowatt hours you draw from the system, it still costs you the same, then why would you even bother charging people by the kilowatt hour?
Because it's profitable, extremely profitable.
You know, just figure out, okay, you've got a 100 amp meter, we're going to charge you X amount. Now, for industrial customers, maybe it's a different story, but for domestic customers, but that, in some ways, when you look at smart meters, the whole point of smart meters is to eliminate the cost of sending some guy around to read the meter. If they had to pay somebody to go around and read the meter, it might not be worth it. It might just send you a fixed bill every quarter.
I would also like to interject. That's exactly what the company does to me. I have an old school meter that's not smart. It is very dumb. And I have to go out and every so often take a picture of it and send it in so that literally, literally Central Hudson doesn't spend the entire year guessing at my usage.
Oh, yeah. They do that for like the whole year. And you got to send them a picture.
Speculative.
Do you tie the thing to the leg of a pigeon when you send it? Or
yes, I have to carrier pigeon the mimeograph over to them.
Oh, Jesus.
Shapirograph. No, I've got a friend in Nevada who specifically pays an extra fee not to have a smart meter because, at least the ones in Nevada, some of them caught fire.
Okay.
What kind of batteries they putting in there? Lithium?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I
didn't know Samsung made meters.
They're talking about putting dumb mechanical. Even smarter water meters here in Catskill because the batteries ran out on some of them and the water department charged thousands to the people whose meters ran out.
Okay, so they've got water meters powered by batteries, not by, say, a little turbine in the water pipe that runs in the water pipe.
That is
I don't know, Chris, you're thinking, stop it, it's dangerous.
Well, that
of course, you know, the other one is smart gas meters. Do you really want a big package of electronics connected to your gas meter? Is that really a good idea?
I like rolling the dice.
The insurance doesn't care, so we consider it gambling.
So all these reactors that you've been talking about, are they would they be considered once through sort of uranium based fuel?
So that is the current situation.
And, yeah.
You know, that is the current situation.
Do you find that kind of wasteful?
Are we talking thorium reactors here?
No, not thorium. Okay. I'm just bringing up the idea that we put the fuel through once and then, you know, then we're done with it.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. This is purely a legal situation. You may not know this. The United States used to reprocess fuel from civil nuclear power reactors. In other words, take the fuel, separate out the reusable uranium, the reusable plutonium, and the fission products, which is the actual waste. You're typical from the kind of nuclear power plants we have in the United States. Typically, you know, your discharge fuel composition is 95% reusable uranium, 4% fission products, and 1% plutonium. Yep. Now, in West Valley, New York, south of Buffalo, there used to be a nuclear fuel reprocessing plant with a capacity of about 400 tons a year, which is not particularly large. But it existed in the late 60s and early 70s. They shut down to expand the plant and then were never able to reopen it. Firstly, because of additional charges, regulators decided that they needed additional reinforcement against seismic loads. Now, I don't exactly, if you're familiar with the geology of the Great Lakes region, you know, the United States Geological Survey says that the likelihood of an earthquake of above magnitude 5.5 is essentially zero. So that's a bit weird that they'd be required to have special earthquake reinforcement against an earthquake that's never going to happen.
No. Don't say that. No, they do happen. Can happen.
300 to 7,000 years, but yeah, it is a black swan.
No, not even on a scale like that. There, earthquakes in this region are possible. And it's, you know, they didn't guard against the cold in Texas, and look what happened to their windmills. So,
wasn't the cold. That was the 5G they injected in it.
That was the liberal conspiracy. The damn hippies were climbing the towers.
I've actually been through a magnitude roughly 5.5 earthquake, oddly enough, here where I live in Fort Worth. Now, it's not, the epicenter was not here. The epicenter was up in Oklahoma. But as far as how far it reached, it was actually really far reaching. Now, that was an interesting case. People talk about fracking and they talk about earthquakes. As it turns out, it's not the fracking that gets you. It's the disposal wells where they pump down this, you know, used water and brine that came out of the wells. Some idiot up in Oklahoma did not read the geological survey maps properly and started pumping this water into an old meteor crater.
Wow.
As it turns out, the strata underneath meteor craters are heavily fractured, and there was a big shift, and so it produced a low-magnitude earthquake, but one that was felt for hundreds of kilometers. So here, I mean, I noticed the house shifted. I thought there was had been a gust of wind. You know, the big wind comes along, I hear the house shift. If that was like that, and then I noticed that I had a pocket knife hanging from a magnet, and it was just rocking back and forth gently. I said, huh, that was an earthquake! This area is not known for seismicity.
Oklahoma is now in earthquake zone thanks to lots of pumping into the ground, right?
Yeah. Anyway, but, you know, this is one of those things.
I'm moving along.
Back to the reprocessing facility that never got reopened.
Yeah, so that was the one and only commercial nuclear fuel reprocessing facility that ever operated in the United States. In Barnwell, South Carolina, a facility with a capacity of 2,000 tons a year was built in the late 70s. It's never been allowed to open. First, there was a moratorium, and then basically the investors who owned the plant said, we don't know if we're going to be allowed to operate it. It doesn't make sense to start it up. Anyway, but to give you an idea of where we're at currently, in the United States, there's roughly 80,000 tons of discharged nuclear fuel, mostly sitting at the sites of the power stations it was discharged from, either in cooling ponds or in dry casks. Now, you may say 80,000 tons. Boy, that sounds like a lot. So a typical large coal-fired power station, the Cumberland Fossil Plant of the Tennessee Valley Authority, for example, burns 20,000 tons of coal a day.
Mm. Yep.
So 80,000 tons is actually not that huge an amount. Now, if we had a 2,000-ton-per-year fuel reprocessing facility, like the one that was built at Barnwell or like the one the French have at Cap La Hague, which I've been near. I actually took the ferry from Dublin to Cherbourg a couple of years ago, and it actually goes right by there. We could reprocess all the current spent fuel in 40 years. Now, why is that important? Well, again, I said composition is roughly 95% reusable uranium, so 75,000-76,000 tons of uranium of roughly 1% uranium-235 content. You can't efficiently use that. You can use that in the kind of power reactors we now have, but not efficiently. To use it efficiently, you'd want to use, for example, Canadian-style heavy water reactors. I don't know. Am I coming through at all?
You are. Yeah, you are. Yeah.
Okay. The dog's barking in the entryway is just driving me nuts.
We can hear it, but it's pretty low compared to you.
Okay. Good. The mic is supposed to be directional, but I'm never sure how directional it truly is.
It's doing good.
It's doing its part.
Yeah.
Okay. So, 76,000 tons of reusable uranium, 800 tons, let's say, of plutonium, of which 500 tons is plutonium-239, the fissile isotope. The remaining 300 is plutonium-240. Okay, so what does that actually give us? Well, for example, the French are in the position where they would need to re-enrich their recycled uranium in order to use it in nuclear power plants that they already have or ones they might be building. Because there's a rumor that President Macron is going to announce 6 new 1,500-megawatt nuclear power units before Christmas. Now, why would he announce that? Well, you may have noticed the price of natural gas is kind of high.
Yeah, in Europe, yes.
And the Germans are supposed to shut down half of their remaining 7 gigawatts of nuclear on December 31st.
Yeah, and they've already decommissioned so many of them.
Yeah, where are they going to get replacement power? The Belgians? So Belgium actually got to 50% nuclear power before France did, but a series of hostile governments have made it impossible for the Belgian electric utilities to invest in replacing those plants. So if they're taken out of service next year, which is the plan, basically 40, the biggest single chunk of Belgium's electrical generating capacity just goes bye-bye. And there's no plan, right, for replacing that.
What, everybody can't jump on a bicycle and start generating their own juice?
That's the COP26's plan, right? Everybody has to start biking.
Yeah, that's where we're at, right? 26 conference of parties to the Rio de Janeiro Climate Accords. And after 26 conferences, what has actually been accomplished? I mean,
they're shutting
for example,
down the cleanest source of energy that, I mean, Europe is the poster boy, or was, before
and
they started shutting them all down.
400 private jets flew to that conference.
Not to the one state, mega yachts and all that. Yeah.
You know, in quantitative terms, right, according to official figures, German emissions have not decreased at all since 1998. I've had people tell me to my face, Germany's 100% solar now. Mm-hmm. Somebody actually said that to me. German emissions have not fallen at all since 1998, and that's by official figures, which are probably somewhat optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, there's 26 conferences of parties to the Rio de Janeiro Accords, and
the Germans are precise.
You know, And again, you know, you want to look at Germany and France, right? You can look at, for example, the IEA's key world statistic, International Energy Agency, which is different from the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's also different from, it's a unit of the OECD. It's different from the OECD Nuclear Energy Agency. It's also different from the United States Energy Information Agency. All these things have very similar names, and you can get really fouled up on them. But if you look at IEA key world statistics, Germany and France have about the same population. They have very similar economies in terms of GDP, industrialization, all that kind of thing. German emissions are twice those of France per head of population, per euro of GDP, or roughly in total, because, again, their country is about the same size. And the only difference, really, the only difference in the two economies is where they get their electricity.
And France is more heavily nuclear?
France is about 75 to 80% nuclear. The remainder is hydro.
Nice.
They have essentially no fossil fuel electric generation. There's a couple of fossil fuel burning plants in the country which are brought online a week or two in the typical year for when the loads get really high.
It's good to have
and
a
Germany
backup.
Germany has a certain amount of its baseload provided by fossils.
Germany has quite a lot of lignite. This is the odd thing. They've shut down their hard coal burning power stations, but they're still burning lignite, which is a dirtier fuel.
But is it cheaper, more accessible?
The main difference is that lignite is typically strip mined, whereas hard coal is typically mined underground. Although that's by no means universally true, it is typically true. Near me, as a matter of fact, there is what's called Big Brown, which is one of the larger mine-mouth power plants in the country. In other words, there's a lignite strip mine right there in the middle of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, and a big lignite-burning power plant right there on the site. Well, it was claimed that they were going to, for environmental purposes, they were going to stop burning the lignite, which is mined right there, and start burning bituminous coal brought from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming by train.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Every day here where I live, right, every day, there's roughly 100, 110 car string of coal cars, each of which carries 100 to 110 tons of coal, headed south to San Antonio for their coal-burning power plants. And, of course, the same string heads back empty the next day. And so between here and the Powder River Basin, there are, at any given time, between, I guess, 10 and 20 unit coal trains in motion. And that's just for the one set of power plants near San Antonio. But, you know, that's a thing, right? That
clean coal.
I was in Buffalo, New York in the middle of the night a few years ago, which is not something I would recommend to anybody, but, you know, that's how life is sometimes. I was in Buffalo in the middle of the night at the train station there.
Was it winter? Because the only way it gets worse.
I was sitting there, and down the line comes a unit oil train, 100 or 120 oil tank cars, probably moving. You know, it could have been Canadian crude oil. It could have been crude oil from North Dakota.
Yep.
But you know, that's the thing: is that you gotta keep the lights on. You gotta keep people warm, right? And if you don't want, you know, New York doesn't want fracking in upstate New York. Okay, I buy that. New York doesn't want pipelines through upstate New York. Okay, I buy that. Well, how are you gonna keep the lights on? How are you gonna keep people warm in the winter? Are you burning heating oil? Is that heating oil coming by train from Alberta, half on the other side of the continent?
We could do a lot of shipping with Hudson.
Up the Hudson. Yeah,
most of ours comes in by boat. Greatly.
Even the trains down here.
Yeah,
just watch the bomb oil trains. Cars whip right past.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and again, you know, this is a thing, that just boggles my mind. That, you know, Andrew Cuomo is gone. But before he left, he managed to succeed in fulfilling a long-term promise, which is to kill the Indian Point nuclear station, Buchanan, New York, you know, up the Hudson from New York City. Now, where does that leave New York City getting its power? Well, one answer is Ravenswood. Ravenswood is kind of interesting. That, I think they burn oil brought in from Venezuela. Not 100% sure on that. Somebody should look into that. But
they're talking about making projects up here where they pump water into a reservoir in the mountains near the Ashikan, which is where they get a lot of their drinking water. And then...
The Ashikan?
Sure, man.
Okay.
The Ashikan. Ah. And then letting it go down to provide hydroelectric during peak hours.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a power supply to pump with, that's the thing, is that because nuclear power stations run best at a continuous heavy load, when Indian Point 2 was built, Con Edison wanted to install a pump storage facility like that, and the environmentalists screamed to high heaven that it was going to destroy the fish habitat in the Hudson River. So apparently this is no longer true if the electricity is coming from somewhere other than a nuclear plant. I regard that as mysterious, mysterious logic.
Well, nuclear power plants do have to draw a lot of water for cooling.
Isn't the Hudson already somewhat poisoned by all the PCBs from GE over decades of manufacture?
Yeah, but a nuclear power plant isn't going to do nearly the same kind of... They won't do any kind of damage like that.
Yeah, well, basically, the one thing... There's two things that a nuclear power plant might do that you wouldn't necessarily like. One thing is it takes in a lot of water, heats it slightly, and discharges it again. Now, some places, they put in cooling towers so that it draws a much smaller amount of water from the nearby body of water. But if you're on a seacoast or a very large river, you know, a cooling tower is usually... sort of an extra expense you don't necessarily need. The second possibility is, if you're drawing in large volumes of water, you could wind up chewing up and killing, you know, small fish. Again, this has not typically been a problem. To give you an example, a great example from my own personal experience, I happened to be in Finland in 2017. The World Science Fiction Convention was in Helsinki, and I convinced the organizers to get us a tour of a nuclear power plant. Now, the nuclear power plant near Helsinki, Loviisa, was not available that week. And so we had to cross the entire country to the Gulf of Bothnia, to Olkiluoto. Crossing Finland is more or less like crossing, I don't know, Michigan or something. It's not a huge way, but it did mean we had had to get on a bus first thing in the morning and go a couple of hours across the country.
Were on quite a journey there, just like our listeners are on an audio journey listening to 90.7 FM, Acre, Hudson, Catskill.
Good. Skill, Joe.
FCC.
Smooth. Back to your journey through science.
But yeah, so as it turns out, at Olkiluoto, we were told that there is a long waiting list for fishing permits. Because the thing is, there's a protected area where you're not allowed, near the discharge of the power plant, where for security reasons, you're not allowed to go without a permit. Well, the fishing there is really great, as it turns out. And so there's a long waiting list for that.
None of these fish are coming out with three eyes or anything?
No, apparently, you know. Apparently, if they are, they're three delicious eyes.
All right.
the seal population is also booming in the area, tells you that good things are going on. Same is true. San Onofre, for real Californians, which has been shut down now, alas. They used to have to warn off fishing boats from getting too close because the fishing was that good. Clearly, you know. The negative and positive effects seem to more or less balance each other out, I guess, is the most fair judgment that can be made. And again, this is partly just due to the fact that when a nuclear power plant is put in, there are very strict requirements for studying its environmental impact on the surrounding area. And so they have laboratories that, you know, catch fish and survey them to find out if they've got radioactive substances in them and all kinds of other things, which are meant to make sure, long before anything important could happen, whether or not there is an effect on people or wildlife or agriculture or any of those other things that are so important to our lives.
A few years down the road, everybody starts walking funny. They start hearing things, each other's thoughts.
So there's a lot in here to unpack. I have a question about what you might think about Gen 4 reactors and how they address the waste problem, which is that, you know, you mentioned that they're keeping a lot of this fuel in need of reprocessing on site, and it has to be stored for, you know, 100 generations. But a lot of the Gen 4 reactor designs are aimed specifically at addressing that problem. Yeah, well, what do you think about sort of them?
So the whole Generation 4 concept is kind of an odd moniker because, of course, you know, one of the key Generation 4 so-called reactors is the sodium-cooled fast breeder reactor.
Which you mentioned they were building in the 1970s. They had them.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, the first electricity, a meaningful electricity ever generated from a nuclear reactor, December 20th, 1951, was from Experimental Breeder Reactor Number 1 out at Idaho Falls. The World Science Fiction Convention is in the winter this year. They actually closes on December 19th, and I'm trying to get the organizers to let me have a space to do an exhibit about nuclear energy just because of the coincidence in time. But yeah, December 20th of this year is the 70th anniversary of the first meaningful generation of electricity, I mean more than a toy scale, literally toy scale, from a nuclear reactor, and that was from a liquid metal cooled fast breeder reactor. Again, another one of the Generation 4 so-called concepts, the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. Helium-cooled, graphite-moderated, uses typically using some degree of thorium fueling. Well,
makes Fort St. Vrain.
Fort St. Vrain was a utility-scale, high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. It was built in the United States in the 1970s. Unfortunately, it was not a technical success. It had nothing to do with the reactor design at all, as it turns out. It was simply due to the fact the gas circulators, the blowers that move the helium gas around in the reactor, were driven by steam turbines. This seemed like a great idea because it meant that if the power went out of the reactor, you could still drive the cooling blowers, right? Good idea. Hmm. One little problem. The systems that they built to keep the steam from leaking into the reactor were not as effective as they should have been. And so they spent a lot of time shut down.
It poisoned the reaction. It poisoned that reaction.
Well, the main thing just is that steam is corrosive.
Right.
And so there was a lot of problem with corrosion that they had to keep shutting down and to repair something. Mm. So it was never an economical reactor. But that problem is solved as now, essentially, because in large-scale natural gas pumping plants, for example, the blowers use magnetic bearings. Magnetic bearings don't require oil lubrication. They don't require water lubrication. You can use an electric motor and a magnetic bearing, and the fact is, in the gas-cooled reactor, the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor using what's called TRISO fuel, cooling circulation isn't required for safety. Because there's no possibility of what you call a fuel meltdown or anything like that. The fuel is actually in the form of tiny ceramic granules which are encased in silicon carbide and graphite. And the result is that even in the worst possible accident, the damage to the fuel is very, very small, and the migration of fission products out of the fuel is very, very small. And so there's no possibility of radioactive releases that would harm the public.
Just big, basically radioactive ball pit.
And the helium isn't that's not at temperature, is it? It's not at a super high temperature or pressure, is it?
Well, the helium, when the reactor's operating, the helium is at a pressure of several tens of atmospheres, much less than the 100 atmospheres typical of the water in a water reactor, but still several tens of atmospheres, and a temperature which can be up to 900 or 1,000 degrees centigrade. This is one of the advantages of the high-temperature reactor, is you don't just use it for generating power. Now, if you use it for generating power, you take the helium out at about 750 degrees centigrade, you produce steam at about 550 degrees centigrade. This allows you to use modern steam equipment, which is not only more efficient but also less expensive than the stuff you have to use in water reactors, which uses lower temperature steam. But the real key is, from the high temperature gas cooled reactor, you can get that heat out at 800, 900, 1,000 degrees centigrade possibly, which means you can do things like steel making, which means you can do coal gasification was a process that was extensively studied in the 1970s.
You can cook a whole lot of chicken.
Yes. World's largest chicken fryer powered by nuclear energy.
Instantly fries 10,000 tons of chicken.
Atomic fried chicken. That is, there you go. You can have that one for free.
Trademark.
Popcorn popper.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We build one of these in central Nebraska and just pop the entire world's supply of popcorn every year.
Pop the whole state.
The whole state. thing.
Hey, what else is Horn Husker.
Oh, man.
Oh. Yeah, so that's
so
a good.
Who is ahead on like current advanced nuclear energy research right now? I know the U.S. is kind of behind on the curve, right? And China, other countries,
yeah, we're just
are,
waiting for our own
and India
Fukushima
are
now.
Actually doing research on, you know, new generation technologies that use that get rid of our current waste and turn it in and take years away from its poison, right? Take away the
so, yeah, I mean, the thing to remember is, you know, again, as I say, the constituents of your spent nuclear fuel, you've got uranium, plutonium, and fission products. Now, fission products come in two groups. One has half-lives that are all shorter than 30 years. That's where the energy is. Cesium-137, strontium-90 are the main constituents there after it's cooled for 3 or 4 years. The other is, and so all that energy is gone within 300 years, right? 300 years is 10 half-lives of the longest live constituents, which means that after 300 years, you don't have to worry about it. There's also a group of fission products which has 100,000-year and longer half-lives, but those have very low energy. So they're not really a concern. As a matter of fact, iodine-129 is one of the best known of these. If all the iodine in your body were iodine-129, it would still be less than the allowable body burden, so it's not really something to worry about. not that I'm recommending this, right, but, you
I don't know about that, since it accumulates in the thyroid, and that could break down your thyroid pretty badly.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Iodine-131...
That point aside...
Yeah, iodine-131, with a half-life of 9 days, 8 days, is dangerous to your thyroid. It's got a lot of energy, and it delivers it rapidly. Iodine-129, with a half-life in the hundreds of thousands of years, you know, you would wait a long time for a single decay.
It's like getting a dental X-ray.
Right.
But I'm getting off the point here. The point is that people say, oh, you got to keep this stuff safe for a quarter of a million years or whatever. Well, they're talking about plutonium. The only sensible thing to do with plutonium is to shove it into a power reactor and use it up. The United States has 34 tons of surplus weapons plutonium. We have an agreement with the Russians to fabricate that into reactor fuel and put it into a reactor and use it up. We made that agreement over 20 years ago, and we still haven't done it. We spent billions of dollars trying to come up with a so-called alternative disposition scheme that the agreement we have with the Russians doesn't actually allow us to do. Why? Because the political climate in the United States, there's a political rule that you don't use plutonium for civil power reactor fuel. Why? It doesn't even make any sense. Okay, but that's the thing. I mean, saw a thing recently that said, you know, climate, you know, carbon dioxide emissions are being undercounted. And they start off by saying, this Al Gore-backed study. And I said, well, I wouldn't trust Albert Gore Jr. further than I can throw him, because he talks a lot about climate, but he has never expressed a single word of regret over killing the IFR program. IFR, the Integral Fast Reactor, is the most advanced nuclear power plant concept in the world, quite possibly. And the United States was the world leader with this concept. See, IFR was a fast reactor, right? Fast breeder reactor with a high breeding ratio, meaning that when you build a plant, the time that it takes to produce enough surplus plutonium to build a second plant of the same kind is shorter, which if you want to replace fossil fuels, you want to build these things as rapidly as possible, right? So the high breeding ratio is a benefit. Now, IFR had the interesting characteristic, it used metallic fuel, which was reprocessed on site. In other words, you make an initial load of fuel for it, take that to the reactor site, and then the actual fuel recycling was all done at the reactor site. Now, this isn't some kind of hypothetical approach. This was actually done. EBR-2, Experimental Breeder Reactor Number 2 at ARCO, Idaho, actually operated in this mode for years, taking the fuel out of the core, reprocessing it in an attached facility, putting it back into the core. Now, this is the IFR concept, to scale this up to a practical power plant level and hopefully bring the costs reasonably down. The U.S. was the world leader in this, and then we said, we're not going to do this anymore. Yeah, I mean, China is talking about building high-temperature gas-cooled reactors specifically to replace coal-fired boilers at existing power plants, because they would produce steam at the same steam conditions that the coal-fired boilers do, modern coal-fired boilers. that would be a major step forward, right?
Yeah,
you can't
move from coal to nuclear.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, it actually...
They're a major consumer of coal.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
They burn the most, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. China is a huge user of coal, huge producer, and yet they use so much they have to import it.
Well, actually, they burn more coal than the rest of the world combined.
Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, so, North China, right. North China is one of the world's richest coal-producing provinces, and yet they burn so much coal they also have to import it from Australia. And I mean, even North Korea sells coal to China.
Most of Australia's grid is coal.
Yeah, Australia is very coal-heavy. Yep. Australia is one of the world's largest exporters of uranium, but it is illegal to have a nuclear power plant in Australia.
What? Just flat out, they don't have any...
Yeah. There is a law against it. There is one reactor in the whole country. It's a research reactor. Doesn't generate power. It does produce much of the supply of medical isotopes used in the Southern Hemisphere. It also produces a lot of high-quality N-type silicon, because it turns out that for high-power switching devices, triacs and thyristors, SCRs, those kinds of things, particularly the kind that are used for grid tie inverters for solar and wind installations, those are actually made in nuclear reactors.
No way.
Yeah. See, the thing is, the traditional method for making N-type semiconductor silicon is to take high-purity silicon wafers and put them into a furnace and diffuse them with phosphine gas, and that embeds phosphorus atoms in the wafer, and that gives you an excess of charge carriers. Super it's what's safe. Called N-type silicon. If you ever look at transistors in a catalog or anything, most of them are what's called NPN rather than PNP, and it just has to do with the fact that N-type silicon is easier to manufacture and get high quality. But here's the thing. N-type silicon made by diffusion is uneven. The phosphorus density in the silicon varies. So there'll be clumps with a high gain and clumps with a low gain. And for small signal transistors, this isn't much of a problem. But for big, high-power switching devices, it can mean that two, what are supposed to be identical devices, one of them dissipates twice as much power as the other, which is bad. That can lead to your system blowing up, literally. Normally it doesn't, because good designers take other measures to make sure that doesn't happen, but it does happen from time to time. Anyway, so how do you get high-quality, uniform semiconductor silicon? Answer is, you take that high-purity silicon boule, as it's called, big ingot, and instead of slicing it and diffusing it, you stick it in a nuclear reactor. What happens then? Well, a small proportion of the silicon atoms will absorb a neutron. They become a radioactive, short-lived isotope of silicon, which decays almost immediately to phosphorus. And then you produce N-type silicon, where the phosphorus is very, very uniformly distributed through the whole of the material, which means you have high-quality material, which you can then slice up and make into high-power switching devices. Now, if there were a bigger supply of this, everybody would be using it, right? But as it is, your grid tie inverters for your solar installation on your rooftop, grid tie inverters for a wind machine, the power controllers in your electric car, all of these things use silicon, which is made in nuclear reactors.
Everything that's brought the cost of that down to the point where a consumer can afford something like those tie-ins, those inverters.
You need it to make... You have to have that much product in the first place. So... The more nuclear reactors we have, the more we might be able to accelerate our technology.
I mean, you know, that's the thing, is that, yeah, if we had larger supplies of this stuff, again, not made in power reactors, it's made in another kind of reactor entirely, research reactors that could potentially be made in the Canadian-style power reactors, but in practice, it's currently not being done. But it is being made in research reactors. I visited one, actually, at the beginning of October, just a month ago, first Sunday in October, at Garching, north of Munich. Really great. I actually got a personal guided tour of the facility. I will say, they refer to it always as a neutron source. They don't call it a nuclear reactor. They ask you, please don't say that. This is Germany. People will tar and feather us.
We have rebranded it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the only thing in the whole name, it's known as the Heinz-Meyer-Leibniz-Forschungsneutronenquelle, the Heinz-Meyer-Leibniz Research Neutron Source. And then in small brackets, it says FRM2, where FRM stands for Forschungsreaktor Munich. In other words, Research Reactor Munich. So it's, anyway, but that's just hilarious to me, is that I the guy actually said, just don't talk about it as a nuclear reactor, please. But yeah, so yeah, Australia has a law against nuclear power plants. Now, the funny thing is, Australia actually started building, Australia, a major exporter of uranium, right? Why don't they produce nuclear power the way Canada does? Well, in the early 1970s, they actually started a nuclear power program, and then it was abandoned almost immediately for the dumbest reason. I'm going to give you a dumb story about Australia. In the late 60s, early 70s, Australia, the Australian government had this bee in its bonnet at the highest levels. The Prime Minister and his closest circle of advisors, they thought they needed nuclear weapons. They thought they needed an independent thermonuclear deterrent force, independent of their close allies, the U.S. and Great Britain. So they said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to order a nuclear power plant, and then we're going to use plutonium from the nuclear power plant to make our own atom bombs, right?
Yeah.
This is the scenario that everybody tells you, oh, no, nuclear power plants could, you know, lead to nuclear weapons. Well, what actually happened was they set up a scientific and technical committee to choose the best nuclear reactor for Australia. And they picked the British steam-generating heavy water reactor, which is irrelevant, except they started construction on it, and then somebody pointed out to the Prime Minister that this would not be suitable for making nuclear weapons. Because the thing was, they had not told the technical committee that that was the objective.
Oh,
and
my
so the technical
God,
committee,
why? They'll drop it.
And so the technical committee selected a reactor design which would be completely unsuitable for this purpose.
It doesn't breed and plutonium.
Well, it's the thing. The thing is, it does produce plutonium, but so here's the key. So there's very few. If you want to make plutonium for bombs, you have to leave the uranium in the reactor a quite short time, and you have to reprocess large volumes of uranium. And so your typical production reactor, in other words, the reactor that's used for producing military plutonium, it uses slugs of uranium metal as fuel in fairly simple metal jackets. Because you're fabricating huge numbers of these slugs, you're feeding them in one at a time, and then you're taking them out and dissolving them in acid.
It sounds like a really fun bullet.
You don't want to deal with processing ceramides like silicon carbide and graphite.
Exactly. You don't want to deal with that. So the thing is, you know, so there's only really one family of power reactors that ever used fuel like that. That was the British Magnox reactors, which are derived from the Calder Hall and Chapel Cross plutonium production reactors. Fun thing about Calder Hall and Chapel Cross is that almost from the beginning, they were run more as power stations than as plutonium producers. The fuel charges were left in the reactor so long that, firstly, much of the plutonium that was produced was then consumed in the reactor. And secondly, much of what was left was converted to plutonium-240, which is bad for bomb making. It's something you want to avoid. Anyway, but those are simple metallic slugs. Now, for a reactor that uses a ceramic fuel, such as uranium oxide, very popular fuel, you know, the cost of fabricating it, the cost of reprocessing it is considerably higher. It's also really, really obvious. Right. Because the thing is, if you had, say, a CANDU reactor, in principle, you could use a CANDU reactor to make weapons plutonium, but you'd have to feed the fuel in 10 times as rapidly as you do for power reactor operation. So if you're building a fuel production plant and it's 10 times as large, that's really obvious.
Yeah. So it's one or the other, not, yeah.
It's a cookie factory.
Yeah. I mean, to give you an idea, when the first Magnox stations were being built, to be clear, these were derived directly from military plutonium-producing reactors. Nevertheless, the defense ministry in Britain said, "Oh, we're going to have to fit these so they can produce weapons-grade plutonium." And the Central Electricity Generating Board screamed to high heaven. They said that will ruin the economics of our beautiful new power plants. But yeah, so. So the Australian nuclear power experience is bizarre, and is even getting more bizarre now with this insane announcement that the United States and Britain are going to supply Australia with nuclear-powered submarines. Firstly, it's illegal. It's still illegal. Secondly...
Is it, though? Is it illegal to have them in Australian waters?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you're not allowed to have a nuclear power plant in Australia. Presumably, this applies to the government.
And each submarine is a significant power plant.
Does the law ever supply to the government?
But then there's the additional thing. So the Australians, when they negotiated the deal to buy submarines from France in the first place, it was explicitly stated that the French could provide nuclear submarines if the Australians changed their mind. So that part doesn't make any sense. The part that really doesn't make any sense is this. U.S. naval reactors and British naval reactors, which are based on the U.S. design, use bomb-grade uranium, of which the U.S. doesn't have very much at all, because we shut down the plants that made that stuff decades ago. We don't have enough for the naval program we already have, so where is it going to come from to supply the British?
A supply chain for the fuel for those submarines. Like, it's all
we do not.
They'll have to source it from, I don't know, North Korea or something.
Well, that means we got to build a new reactor for that.
There you go.
Yeah,
a new reactor design for the ships.
Yeah.
Or just
the
make
French,
sure we have, you know, people that can supply us.
The French naval reactors use much lower enrichments. They have a plant that makes the fuel for French naval reactors. So where this whole Australia deal makes no sense whatsoever to me. That's just... I'm just laying it out there. But yeah, if I were specifying a new generation of power reactors in the United States, you know, there'd be two types I would specify. The first would be IFRs. In other words, that fast breeder reactor to get rid of that 34 tons of weapons plutonium we're supposed to get rid of, and also the roughly 800 tons of plutonium we would get from recycling our existing nuclear fuel. Second type of reactor I would specify is the Canadian-style heavy water reactors. Why? Because they get twice as much energy out of the recycled uranium as if we re-enrich that and put that into light water reactors. And, you know, between those two, and also re-enriching some of our depleted uranium, we could easily add another 100 gigawatts. You know, we have roughly 100 gigawatts of nuclear electric generating capacity in this country right now. We could easily add another 100 in the coming 10, 15 years without mining a single ton of uranium.
Just using the old waste.
Yeah, just using the existing stocks of spent fuel that are already above ground and the existing stocks of depleted uranium.
And also now, taking the fangs out of that waste while we're doing it.
Right. That's the thing, is that we separate the nuclear... spent nuclear fuel into the long-lived hazardous actinides, uranium, plutonium, and the short-lived, less dangerous fission products. Hey, we put the actinides into a reactor and use them up. Now, thing is another 100 gigawatts of nuclear gonna cut it? No, okay? People talk about electrifying transportation. If you actually had 100 million electric cars in this country...
Yeah. 100 you know, million we, chargers... A ton more use of the entire electrical grid. Yep. A lot of people looking for all the batteries that they've been killing and trying to swap out. Eventually, their cars stop working. They start slaughtering each other for their batteries.
Even more advanced. I load.
Need more power.
It seems like Joe has stuff that's through.
And then you see the guys driving along with the diesel generators on the little trailer behind them.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, exactly. You know, I was in the Verkehrszentrum, the Deutsches Museum, the Transportation Museum in Munich. They have one of these cars from the Second World War period that had a charcoal-burning oven on a little trailer behind it to provide producer gas to burn in the car's engine.
Yes!
Yeah.
Oh, I love looking at the wood gas-powered cars on the internet.
We are starting to run out of time, so is there any sort of message you want to get out there before we wrap up?
I think that last one was a pretty strong one.
That was pretty strong. IFRs and... what did you say?
Heavy water reactors. Canadian-style heavy water reactors.
Get rid of our waste by using it.
How do we make people happy to put them in their own backyard? Like, they don't start picketing with, you know, words like Fukushima and Chernobyl on their placards.
Yeah, you have two
minutes. Hard because... People have this doomsday mentality, but it only applies to nuclear. It's weird. They're willing to have natural gas lines running to their house. Mm-hmm. People are killed by natural gas explosions every year. Yeah, it's never happened in a civil power plant in the United States.
A little bit Massachusetts a couple years ago.
A few whole neighborhoods got blown sky high just because, like, one guy turned on a valve too fast.
But yeah, and in Dallas, Texas, at the beginning of last year, there was a 12-year-old honor student blown up by a gas explosion. And again, that nobody has ever been killed by a nuclear reactor accident in a civil power station in the United States. But
that's a lot of qualifiers. Yes.
Calm down.
Anyway, let's see. I got a website, man-and-atom.info. Anybody wants to send me some mail, including mail with a check in it, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101. And people who want to send me PayPal, paypal.me/PrometheusLives. Anyway, and I will be happy to send you. I've got stickers. I've got buttons. I got all kinds of neat stuff I'd be happy to give anybody who wants it.
Yeah, he sent some cool stickers from the power plant in Germany that he talked about.
Give it a check. Give it a look, people. This man's worth it.
We have 1 minute.
1 minute? Probably less than that. You've been listening to the Thingularity radio program, and if you would like to keep listening to us, we might just keep on going into an after show. Who knows?
Maybe.
But